Chapter 15. In Need of a Bellfounder. The box-like wagon reminded Matt of tinker wagons he had seen, a little house on wheels, though this one, filled with cabinets and workbenches built into the walls, was not made for a dwelling. Wrinkling his nose at the odd, acrid smells that filled the interior, he shifted uncomfortably on his three-legged stool, the only place for anyone to sit. His broken leg and ribs were near enough healed, and the cuts that he had suffered when that whole bloody building fell on his head, but the injuries still pained him now and then. Besides, he was hoping for sympathy. Women love to show sympathy, if you played it out right. He made himself stop twisting his long signet ring on his finger. Let a woman know you were nervous, and she put her own construction on it, and sympathy went right out the window.
"Listen, Aludra," he said, assuming his most winning smile. "By this time you must know the Shan-Chan won't look twice at fireworks. Those Damani do something called skylights that makes your best fireworks look like a few sparks flying up the chimney, so I hear. No offense meant." "Me, I have not seen these so-called skylights myself," she replied dismissively in her strong Tarabiner accent. Her head was bent over a wooden mortar the size of a large keg on one of the workbenches, and despite a wide blue ribbon gathering her dark, waist-length hair loosely at the nape of her neck, it fell forward to hide her face. The long white apron with its dark smudges did nothing to conceal how well her dark green dress fit over her hips, but he was more interested in what she was doing. Well, as interested. She was grinding at a coarse black powder with a wooden pestle nearly as long as her arm. The powder looked a little like what he had seen inside fireworks he had cut open, but he still did not know what went into it. "In any event," she went on, unaware of his scrutiny, "I will not give you the guild secrets. You must understand this, yes?" Matt winced. He had been working on her for days to bring her to this point, ever since a chance visit to Valen Luka's traveling show revealed that she was here in Ebudar, and all the while he had dreaded that she would mention the Illuminator's Guild. "But you aren't an Illuminator anymore, remember? They kicked, you said you left the Guild." Not for the first time, he considered a small reminder that he had once saved her from four Guild members who wanted to cut her throat. That sort of thing was enough to make most women fall on your neck with kisses and offers of whatever you wanted. But there had been a notable lack of kisses when he actually saved her, so it was unlikely she would begin now. "Anyway," he went on airily, "you don't have to worry about the guild. You've been making night flowers for how long? And nobody has come around trying to stop you. Why, I'll wager you never see another Illuminator."
"What have you heard?"
she asked quietly, her head still down. The pestle's rotation slowed almost to a stop.
"Tell me."
The hair on his scalp nearly stood on end. How did women do that? Hide every clue, and they still went straight to what you wanted to conceal.
"What do you mean? I hear the same gossip you do, I suppose. Mostly about the Shan-Chan."
She spun around so fast that her hair swung like a flail, and snatched the heavy pestle up in both hands, brandishing it overhead. Perhaps 10 years or so older than he, she had large, dark eyes and a small, plump mouth that usually seemed ready to be kissed. He had thought about kissing her a time or two. Most women were more amenable after a few kisses. Now her teeth were bared, and she looked ready to bite off his nose.
"Tell me,"
she commanded.
"I was playing at dice with some Shan-Chan down near the docks," he said reluctantly, keeping a careful eye on the upraised pestle.
A man might bluff and bluster and walk away if the matter was not serious, but a woman could crack your skull on a whim. And his hip was aching and stiff from sitting too long. He was not sure how quickly he could move from that stool.
"I didn't want to be the one to tell you, but the guild doesn't exist anymore, Aludra. The chapter house in Tanchico is gone."
That had been the only real chapter house in the guild. The one in Kyrian was long abandoned now, And for the rest, illuminators only traveled to put on displays for rulers and nobles. They refused to let Shanchan soldiers inside the compound, and fought, tried to, when they broke in anyway. I don't know what happened. Maybe a soldier took a lantern where he shouldn't have. But half the compound exploded, as I understand it. Probably exaggeration. But the Shanchan believed one of the illuminators used the one power, and they... He sighed and tried to make his voice gentle. Blood and ashes, he did not want to tell her this. But she was glaring at him, that bloody club poised to split his scalp. Aludra, the Shanchan gathered up everyone left alive at the chapter house and some illuminators that had gone to Amador, and everybody in between who even looked like an illuminator, and they made them all Daco Vale. That means...
I know what it means, she said fiercely.
Swinging back to the big mortar, she began pounding away with the pestle so hard that he was afraid the thing might explode if that powder really was what went inside fireworks.
Fools, she muttered angrily, thumping the pestle loudly in the mortar. Great blind fools! With the mighty you must bend your neck a little and walk on, but they would not see it.
Sniffing, she scrubbed at her cheeks with the back of her hand.
You are wrong, my young friend. So long as one illuminator lives, the guild, it lives too. And me? I still live.
Still not looking at him, she wiped her cheeks with her hand again.
And what would you do if I gave you the fireworks? Hurl them at the Shanchan from the catapult, I suppose?
Her snort told what she thought of that.
And what's wrong with the idea?
He asked defensively. A good field catapult, a scorpion, could throw a 10-pound stone 500 paces, and 10 pounds of fireworks would do more damage than any stone.
Anyway, I have a better idea. I saw those tubes you used to toss nightflowers into the sky. 300 paces or more, you said. Tip one on its side, more or less, and I'll bet I could toss a nightflower 1,000 paces.
Peering into the mortar, she muttered almost under her breath.
Me, I talk too much,
he thought it was, and something about pretty eyes that made no sense. He hurried on to stop her from starting up about guild secrets again.
Those tubes are a lot smaller than a catapult, Aludra. If they were well hidden, the Shanchan would never know where they came from. You could think of it as paying them back for the chapter house.
Turning her head, she gave him a look of respect. Mingled with surprise, but he managed to ignore that. Her eyes were red-rimmed, and there were tear stains on her cheeks. Maybe if he put an arm around her. Women usually appreciated a little comforting when they cried. Before he could even shift his weight, she swung the pestle between them, pointing it at him like a sword with one hand. Those slender arms must be stronger than they looked. The wooden club never wavered.
Light, he thought. She couldn't have known what I was going to do. This is not bad, for one who only saw the lofting tubes a few days ago, she said. But me, I have thought about this long before you. I had reason.
For a moment, her voice was bitter, but it smoothed out again, and became a little amused.
I will set you the puzzle, since you are so clever, no?
She said, arching an eyebrow. Oh, she definitely was amused by something.
You tell me what use I might have for a bell founder, and I will tell you all of my secrets, even the ones that will make you blush, yes?
Now that did sound interesting. But the fireworks were more important than an hour snuggling with her. What secrets did she have that could make him blush? He might surprise her there. Not all of those other men's memories that had been stuffed into his head had to do with battles. A bellmaker, he mused, without a notion of where to go from there. None of those old memories gave even a hint.
Well, I suppose a bellmaker could... maybe...
No, she said, suddenly brisk.
You will go and return in 2 or 3 days. I have the work to do, and you are distracting with all of your questions and wheedling. No, no arguments. You will go now.
Glowering, he rose and clapped his wide-brimmed black hat onto his head.
Wheedling? Wheedling? Blood and bloody ashes!
He had dropped his cloak in a heap by the door on entering, and he grunted softly, bending to pick it up. He had been sitting on that stool most of the day. But maybe he had made a little headway with her. If he could solve her puzzle, anyway. Alarm bells. Gongs to sound the hour. It made no sense.
I might think of kissing such a smart young man as you, if he did not belong to another, she murmured in decidedly warm tones. You have such a pretty bottom.
He jerked erect, keeping his back to her. The heat in his face was pure outrage, but she was sure to say he was blushing. He could usually manage to forget what he was wearing, unless someone brought it up. There had been an incident, or three, in taverns. While he was flat on his back with his leg in splints and his ribs strapped and bandages just about everywhere else, Tylan had hidden all of his clothes. He had not found where yet, but surely they were hidden, not burned. After all, she could not mean to hold on to him forever. All that remained of his own were his hat and the black silk scarf tied around his neck, and the silvery foxhead medallion, of course, hanging on a leather cord under his shirt, and his knives. He really would have felt lost without those. When he finally managed to crawl out of that bloody bed, the bloody woman had had new clothes made for him, with her sitting there watching the bloody seamstresses measure and fit him. Snowy lace at his wrists almost hid his bloody hands unless he was careful, and more spilled from his neck almost to his flaming waist. Tylan liked lace on a man. His cloak was a brilliant scarlet, as red as his too tight breeches, and edged with golden scrollwork and white roses of all bloody things, not to mention a white oval on his left shoulder, with House Mitsubar's green sword and anchor. His coat was blue enough for a tinker, worked in red and gold Tyran mazes across the chest and down the sleeves for good measure. He did not like recalling what he had been forced to go through to convince Tylan to leave off the pearls and sapphires, and the light alone knew what else she had wanted. And it was short, to boot. Indecently short. Tylan liked his bloody bottom, too, and she did not seem to mind who saw it. Settling the cloak around his shoulders, it was some covering, at least. He grabbed his shoulder-high walking staff from where it was leaning beside the door. His hip and leg were going to wake until he could walk the pain away. "In 2 or 3 days, then," he said, with as much dignity as he could muster. Aludra laughed softly. Not softly enough that he could not hear, though. Light, but a woman could do more with a laugh than a dockside bully boy with a string of curses. And just as deliberately. Limping out of the wagon, he slammed the door behind him as soon as he was far enough down the wooden steps that were fastened to the wagon bed. The afternoon sky was just like the morning sky had been, gray and blustery, thatched with sullen clouds. A sharp wind gusted fitfully. Altara had no true winter, but what it did have was enough to be going on with. Rather than snow, there were icy rains and thunderstorms racing in off the sea, and in between it was damp enough to make the cold seem harder. The ground had a sodden feel under your boots even when it was dry. Scowling, he hobbled away from the wagon. Women. Maludra was pretty, though, and she did know how to make fireworks. A bell founder? Maybe he could make it a short 2 days, so long as Aludra did not start chasing him. A good many women seem to be doing that of late. Had Tylan changed something about him to make women pursue him the way she herself did? No, that was ridiculous. The wind caught his cloak, flaring it behind him, but he was too absorbed to master it. A pair of slender women, acrobats, he thought, gave him sly smiles as they passed, and he smiled and made his best leg. Tylan had not changed him. He was still the same man he had always been.
Luca's show was 50 times as large as what Tom had told him about, maybe more. A sprawling hodgepodge of tents and wagons the size of a large village. Despite the weather, a number of performers were practicing where he could see them. A woman in a flowing white blouse and breeches as tight as his swung back and forth on a sagging rope slung between two tall poles, then threw herself off and somehow caught her feet in the rope just before she hurtled to the ground below. Then she twisted to catch the rope with her hands, pulled herself back to her seat, and began the same thing again. Not far off, a fellow was running on top of an egg-shaped wheel that must have been a good 20 feet long, mounted on a platform that put him higher above the ground when he dashed across the narrow end, than the woman who was going to break her full neck soon. Matt eyed a bare-chested man who was rolling 3 shiny balls along his arms and across his shoulders without ever touching them with his hands. That was interesting. He might be able to manage that himself. At least those balls would not leave you bleeding and broken. He had had enough of that to suit him in a lifetime. What really caught his eyes, however, were the horse lines. Long horse lines, where 2 dozen men bundled against the cold were shoveling dung into barrows. Hundreds of horses. Supposedly, Luca had given shelter to some Shonshan animal trainer, and his reward had been a warrant signed by the High Lady Suroth herself, allowing him to keep all of his animals. Matt's own Pips was secure, saved from the lottery ordered by Suroth because he was in the Tarasin Palace stables, but getting the gelding out of those stables was beyond him. Tylin, as good as, had a leash around his neck, and she did not intend to let him go any time soon. Turning away, he considered having Vannon steal some of the show's horses if the talks with Luca went badly. From what Matt knew of Vannon, it would be an evening stroll for the unlikely man. Fat as he was, Vannon could steal and ride any horse ever foaled. Unfortunately, Matt doubted he himself could sit a saddle for more than a mile. Still, it was something to consider. He was growing desperate. Limping along, idly eyeing tumblers and jugglers and acrobats at their practice, he wondered how matters had come to this pass. Blood and ashes. He was Tavirin. He was supposed to shape the world around him. But here he was, stuck in Ebudar, Tylan's pet and toy. The woman had not even let him heal completely before leaping on him again like a duck on a beetle, while everyone else was having a fine time of it. With those kinswomen fawning at her heels, likely Nynaeve was lording it over everyone in sight. Once Egwene realized those stark-raving mad Aes Sedai, who had named her Ammerlin, did not really mean it, Talmanis and the Band of the Red Hand were ready to spirit her away. Light Elaine might be wearing the rose crown by now, if he knew her. Rand and Perrin probably were lolling in front of a fire in some palace, swilling wine and telling jokes. He grimaced and rubbed at his forehead as a faint rush of colors seemed to swirl inside his head. That happened lately whenever he thought about either man. He did not know why, and he did not want to know. He just wanted it to stop. If only he could get away from Ebudar. And take the secret of fireworks with him, of course. But he would take escape over the secret any day. Tom and Beslin were still where he had left them, drinking with Luca in front of Luca's elaborately decorated wagon. But he did not join them immediately. For some reason, Luca had taken an instant dislike to Matt Cawthon. Matt returned the favor, but with reason. Luca had a smug, self-satisfied face and a way of smirking at any woman in sight. And he seemed to think every woman in the world enjoyed looking at him. Like the man was married. Sprawled in a gilded chair he must have stolen from a palace, Luca was laughing and making expansive, lordly gestures to Tom and Beslin, seated on benches to either side of him. Golden stars and comets covered Luca's brilliant red coat and cloak. A tinker would have blushed. His wagon would have made a tinker weep. Much larger than Aludra's work wagon, the thing appeared to have been lacquered. The faces of the moon repeated themselves in silver all the way around the wagon, and golden stars and comets in every size covered the rest of the red and blue surface. In that setting, Beslin looked almost ordinary in a coat and cloak worked in swooping birds. Tom, knuckling wine from his long white mustaches,
seemed positively drab in plain bronze-colored wool and a dark cloak. One person who should have been there was not, but a quick glance around found a cluster of women at a nearby wagon. They were every age, from his own up to graying hair, but every one of them was giggling at what they surrounded. Sighing, Matt made his way there.
"Oh, I just cannot decide,"
came a boy's piping voice from the center of the group.
"When I look at you, Maracy, your eyes are the prettiest I've ever seen. But when I look at you, Nylan, yours are. Your lips are ripe cherries, Jillin, and yours make me want to kiss them, Adria. And your neck, Jemine, graceful as a swan's."
Swallowing an oath, Matt quickened his pace as much as he could and pushed through the women muttering apologies left and right. Alvar was in the middle of them, a short, pale boy, posturing and grinning at one woman, then another. That toothy grin alone was enough that any of them might decide to slap his ears off in a moment.
"Please forgive him," Matt murmured, taking the boy's hand. "Come on, Alvar. We have to get back to the city. Stop waving your cloak about.
He doesn't know what he's saying, really. I don't know where he picks up that sort of thing." Luckily, the women laughed and ruffled Ulver's hair as Matt led him away. Some murmured that he was a sweet boy, of all things. One slipped her hand under Matt's cloak and pinched his bottom. Women! Once clear, he scowled at the boy, tripping along happily at his side. Ulver had grown since Matt first met him, but he was still short for his years, and with that wide mouth and ears to match, he would never be handsome.
"You could get yourself in deep trouble talking to women that way," Matt told him. "Women like a man to be quiet and well-mannered and reserved. Reserved and maybe a little shy. Cultivate those qualities and you'll do well."
Ulver gave him a gaping, incredulous stare, and Matt sighed. The lad had a fistful of uncles looking after him, and every one except Matt himself was a bad influence. Tom and Beslin were enough to restore Alver's grin. Pulling his hand free, he ran ahead to them laughing. Tom was teaching him how to juggle and play the harp and the flute, and Beslin was teaching him how to use a sword. His other uncles gave him other lessons in a remarkably varied set of skills. Matt intended to start teaching him to use a quarterstaff and the Two Rivers bow once he had his strength back. What the boy was learning from Chelvannon or the Red Arms, Matt did not want to know. Luca rose from his fancy chair at Matt's approach, his fatuous smile fading to a sour grimace. Eyeing Matt up and down, he swept that ridiculous cloak around himself with a wide flourish and announced in a booming voice,
"I am a busy man. I have much to do. It may be that I soon will have the honor of guesting the High Lady Suroth for a private showing."
Without another word, he strode away holding the ornate cloak with just one hand, so gusts rippled it behind him like a banner. Matt gathered his own with both hands. A cloak was for warmth. He had seen Suroth in the palace, though never closely. As closely as he wanted, though, he could not imagine her giving a moment to Valen Luca's grand traveling show and magnificent display of marvels and wonders, as the streamer strung between two tall poles at the entrance to the show announced in red letters a pace high. If she did, likely she would eat the lions, or frighten them to death.
"Has he agreed yet, Tom?" he asked quietly, frowning after Luca.
"We can travel with him when he leaves Abu Dhar," the weathered man replied. "For a price."
He snorted, blowing out his mustaches, and irritably raked a hand through his white hair.
"We should eat and sleep like kings for what he wants, but knowing him, I doubt we will. He doesn't think we are criminals, since we're still walking free. But he knows we're running from something, or we would travel some other way. Unfortunately, he does not intend to leave until spring, at the earliest."
Matt considered several choice curses.
"Not until spring?"
The light knew what Tylan would have done to him, would have him doing by spring.
Maybe Vannon stealing horses was not such a bad notion.
"Gives me more time for dice," he said, as if it did not matter. If he wants as much as you say, I need to fatten my purse. One thing you can say for the Shan-Chan, they don't seem to mind losing."
He tried to be careful how long he let his luck run, and he had not faced any threats of having his throat slit for cheating, at least since he had been able to leave the palace on his own feet. At first he had believed it was his luck spreading, or perhaps being Taviran finally coming in for something useful.
Beslin regarded him gravely. A dark, slender man, a little younger than Matt, he had been blithely rakish when Matt first met him, always ready for a round of the taverns, especially if it ended with women or a fight. Since the Shan-Chan came, he had grown more serious, though. To him, they were very serious business.
"My mother won't be pleased if she learns I am helping her pretty leave Ebu Dar, Matt. She will marry me to someone with a squint and a mustache like a Tara Bonner foot soldier."
After all this time, Matt still winced. He could never get used to Thailand's son, thinking what his mother was doing with Matt was all right. Well, Beslin did believe she had become a little too possessive, just a little, mind, but that was the only reason he was willing to help. Beslin claimed Matt was what his mother needed to take her mind off the agreements she had been forced into by the Shan-Chan. Sometimes Matt wished he was back in the Two Rivers, where at least you knew how other people thought. Sometimes he did.
"Can we return to the palace now?" Ulver said,
more a demand than a question.
"I have a reading lesson with the Lady Rizel. She lets me rest my head on her bosom while she reads to me."
"A notable achievement, Ulver," Tom said, stroking his mustaches to hide a smile.
Leaning closer to the other two men, he pitched his voice to escape the boy's ears.
"The woman makes me play the harp for her before she lets me rest my head on that magnificent pillow."
"Rizel makes everyone entertain her first," Beslin chuckled in a knowing way, and Tom stared at him in astonishment.
Matt groaned. It was not his leg this time, or the fact that every man in Ebu Dar seemed to be choosing the bosom they rested their heads on, except for Matt Cawthon. Those bloody dice had just started tumbling in his head again. Something bad was coming his way. Something very bad.